Latter-day Peace Studies is produced by peace-loving members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Any views expressed herein are not to be taken as official positions of the Church or its authorities.
Latter-day Peace Studies presents Come Follow Me. I'm Christopher Hurtado.
And I'm Ben Peterson.
Thank you for joining us as we discuss this week's reading of Come Follow Me as outlined by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Our hope is that as we discuss the scriptures, we will come to a more perfect understanding through experiencing the atonement of Jesus Christ and find greater peace in our lives.
Welcome back to Latter-day Peace Studies presents Come Follow Me. I'm your co-host, Ben Peterson.
And I'm your co-host, Christopher Hurtado. It's good to be with you, Ben.
Today, we get to cover 1 John, 2 John, and 3 John, and the letter of Jude. Now, these three letters of John, I think, as we were coming into them from all the other letters that we've covered, I half expected them to be all from different authors, right?
Same here.
And it turns out that there's a pretty strong opinion among a good number of scholars that these are all from the same author or from the same tradition community, so to speak, right?
Well, same. I would agree, same tradition. And the first two, you know, yeah, same author maybe. And the third one, I'm not so sure. But yeah, I get it.
Now, these have been attributed to John the Evangelist or John the Beloved, who is considered or the author of the Gospel of John, or the Gospel of John is attributed to him as well. But the letters are all anonymous. They don't actually say, you know, John, an apostle of Jesus Christ, right? Like we get from James or Peter or the letters of Paul or even pseudo-Paul, right?
Yeah, there's just one little thing at the beginning of the third letter. It's the elder, right?
Yeah.
Whatever that means.
Yeah, whatever that means. And it seems like this would have been a prominent member or members of the Johannine community, the Johannine community, which is the people, the churches, so to speak, that followed after the tradition or had a particular view of Jesus and his teachings that are consistent with what we find in these letters and consistent with what we find in the Gospel of John.
I'm going to add a third pronunciation just to keep it interesting. Johannine.
Johannine. There you go.
Yeah, I mean, this is a Johannine school, right? I mean, I think we can say that there are some similarities between not the writing, but the terms, right? The terms used by these authors or this author and the Gospel of John author. And that reminds me of something else about the third letter that I'll bring up, and that is that it's more Jewish than the other two and does look more like John in that sense. But again, I'm not saying it's John. I'm saying it's Johannine.
Yeah. And as we read through the letters, you can kind of see that while they do talk about and use similar terminology to what we find in the Gospel of John, the theology is not as rhetorically developed as we might see in the Gospels. And so that led some to think that these letters were written before the Gospel. However, scholars have more since considered these letters to be written after because there's situational context that points to divisions within the community, particularly within this first letter of John, that would have happened sometime after 100 CE. So that would be probably after the Gospel of John was written.
Right, because that's around 90, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 90 to 100, somewhere in there.
Whereas this is probably around 100, right?
Yeah, or thereafter.
Or thereafter.
So the major themes that we find in these letters are love, but particularly the love that unites the community of the believers.
Against others.
Exactly. And so then the contrary theme to that is that there's this threat of the others or the dissenters or the false teachers, and they pose a threat to that unity, that love unity of the community. And I did find that somewhat ironic, right? I think the irony of much of the discourse kind of comes through in this tension. And it's like, if love is what distinguishes the community, then the villainization of the dissenters seems kind of harsh to me. And so there is a point at which the author, particularly of the first letter, tries to resolve this by declaring that the dissenters never really belonged in the first place, right? The fact that they left means that they didn't belong with us in the first place. Now, this kind of did make me remember a discussion that we had on this podcast way back when we podcasted on the Book of Mormon. And we had a discussion about the attitude of the Nephites and their culture and how they sort of thought of themselves with regard to the Lamanites. And we kind of said that the Nephites seemed to have some sort of superiority complex, right? And they were always belittling and denigrating anybody that would dissent from them, right? And this was always the cause for the wars. There were dissenters, and then Lamanites would come after them. And yet there seemed to constantly develop this culture, this Nephite culture that viewed itself as superior, right?
Well, that reminds me of a theme that shows up in these letters, right? Which is those who agree with us are right.
Yeah.
And those who don't agree with us are wrong. And thus we see the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Yeah, exactly. And it was very interesting reading through these to find all the verses about love that we commonly proof text. And there is some really beautiful stuff happening in here with these verses. And when you find them in context, though, you realize that it does seem that the author, as much as the author is talking about love, what they really mean is just loving the people that are part of your community, and that that love isn't to extend in any practical way to people outside that community because they're a threat to that unity, right?
Yeah.
And that was kind of disturbing for me to find, right? To read through these and think that, oh, you know, John, yeah, these have really good statements about love. And they do. There's beautiful concepts and discussions about love in here. And yet it was tainted by this idea, this underlying idea that the love was really only talked about in the context of just loving the people around you, just your neighbor, right? And it did seem sort of it seemed contradictory to me to how Jesus approaches the concept of loving your neighbor when he tells the story of the Good Samaritan, right? But for these people, it was just love the people of your community, right? Your brothers, the people that believe like you.
Yeah, it's contrary to Paul too. So when I talked about the words, you know, the vocabulary that's shows up in these letters, that's Johannine, right? That reminds me of John, of the Gospel of John. It's stuff like light and darkness and truth and lies, that kind of language, a dualistic worldview, mm-hmm. you know, with some kind of tension between this community and other, mark my words, other early followers of Jesus, right? We're not talking right. about non-followers of Jesus. We're talking about other followers of Jesus.
Yeah, it's already become very exclusionary.
Yeah, so we can say too, another thing I think that comes out of this is that, you know, I mentioned before on this podcast that it looks like there's a Jacobite Christianity before Paul comes along. Then there's a Pauline Christianity. It looks like there's a Johannine Christianity. But this, it doesn't surprise us, right? Because we know even from Paul, you know, the people that he writes to, the communities that he writes to, right? They're communities that he founds, right? So they're churches. It's not a church, but there are churches. And yet we have these general or Catholic epistles, right? And that's where these fall. And of course, the third one looks more like a letter of recommendation.
Yeah. And it's a private letter, not meant necessarily
for the second one, audience. I think it's the second one, looks like some kind of sermon. You know, this is, we've seen this before, right?
Yeah.
The first one has a lot going on. Most of what I'll have to talk about is from the first letter.
Yeah, there is a lot going on in the first letter. So we, you know, let's start taking a look here at this. Now, there is some sort of intro happening here at the beginning of this. Now, the whole chapter one of 1 John is written in a first person plural, right? It's we, us, our, indicating all this. But then when you get to chapter two, it switches to a singular first person.
You know, I didn't even pick up on that. That's interesting.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of strange. It was almost like the text, or the maybe original, for lack of a better term, but like an earlier text, might have started where we see chapter 2. And then this other part was maybe written as an introduction to that part, sort of to a heading to the letter, so to speak. And otherwise, it's really strange for it to start off in that we form. It does sort of indicate this is expressing the views and understanding of a community rather than like some specific particular individual, right? And again, that makes sense in the context here because this letter is sort of expressing the unity and identity of a community rather than an individual.
Yeah. And then so we get here, you know, right away that this light and darkness stuff, right? God is light. There's no darkness in him. So if you're with him, you're in the light. And if you're not, you're in the darkness. And, you know, it's got this whole light and dark thing going. And then there's the blood of Jesus that cleanses. And it's interesting because it does say in verse 7 that it cleanses, right? Because we're going to get this idea later on of atonement, right? Atonement's something that shows up here. And atonement is this, 16th century concept that as we were told, is at one ment, right? And it's some kind of, there's this whole theological package that comes with atonement that really has nothing to do with the word that's being translated, which means cleansing, and originally had to do with cleansing the temple. And that did involve sacrifices and blood, right? That's one thing. And of course, it's cleansing the temple and cleansing the people themselves too, right? And then later on involves repentance, but not originally. Here we have this idea that we have to confess our sins to be forgiven. And that is a later idea of cleansing that happens in the Jewish community.
Now, one of the things that stood out to me here in chapter 1 is what we get in verse 8. It says, if we say that we have no sin, we deceive ourselves, and the truth is not in us. Now, despite the fact that this does seem to contradict some later statements here in the letter, I did think this was an interesting statement. It made me think of Paul in 1 Corinthians 8:2, who talks about knowledge, right? He says, anyone who claims to know something does not have sufficient knowledge. And it seemed like kind of the same principle to me, right? Like if you say that you have no sin, right, then you are just, you know, you're obviously, the truth's not in you, right? You, if you say you're a perfect person, right? It's like saying, I'm so proud of my humility, kind of, so to speak, right? You have to acknowledge, right, that there are times when you don't measure up to your own standards, right? Or to the standards that you believe are true. And obviously sin is defined by some of these different authors in different ways. This author talks about sin being lawlessness. Paul talks about sin being simply a refusal to acknowledge grace, right? Which that's very different views of what sin is. James says sin is knowing what's right and not doing it, right? But in any case, you know, I think any of those concepts can apply to us at any given time.
Just to reiterate, the concept here in these letters is sin is
lawlessness.
Yeah, sin is lawlessness. It's defined that way, right? Yes. It's actually spelled out.
Yeah.
And so there are all kinds of concepts here, right, that you really need to look at carefully, because what happens is we come into these texts and we already know what they're saying. And when I say that, when I say we, I mean not you and me, Ben. It's our job to not do, right? To put it in Mater's words, right? To not do, yeah. So it takes effort. Right? It really does. I mean, it really takes a different mindset. That's all. It's just, there's a switch, right? It's okay. I'm going into study mode. This isn't devotional reading, right? Yeah. And if I go into devotional mode, then this isn't an issue, right? At most, you might hear me on our sister podcast, Letter to Contemplation Presents, Come Follow Me. I might quibble over authorship. Other than that, who cares, right? Yeah. It's just, yeah, what's in this, you know, what can I read in here? What wisdom can I find, right?
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
There's this Antichrist idea that shows up here. And this is, again, one of these concepts that we already know what it means, right? An Antichrist. And there is an idea of an Antichrist that we inherited that comes later, but it's not here. It's not in these letters. An Antichrist here just means someone who, now there is, by the way, there's one that's coming, right? The Antichrist in 1 John 2:18. But there are also all these antichrists that are already in the world that are mentioned. We don't get many details about the one who's coming, but there are some details about the ones who have already come. And I think the important thing is to just realize that anti just means against the Messiah. Mm-hmm. And so there's nothing here that implies, and certainly nothing that actually states, that they're somehow satanic, right? That's not what's going on here. They're just anti-Messiah. They're anti-Jesus as Messiah. They've rejected Jesus. They've separated from the community. They're denying that Messiah has come in the flesh. And there's actually some kind of dispute going on here. And we only get the one side. You know, going back to what you said about right. The Nephites, we don't have the writings of Laman and Lemuel, right? And so here we don't have the writings of the heretics. We only have the heresiologist in front of us. And it's not even clear in the heresiology that we're looking at here. I'm calling this heresiology, right? This is somebody writing about the people who are wrong. I guess if it's not heresiology, it's because it doesn't actually spell out what the heresy is. It's really dealing with heretics, not heresy. How about that?
Yeah.
There seem to be two distinct views about Jesus that are at the root of the schism that we're dealing with, right?
Or the two possible heresies going on here.
Right. The author says that Jesus has come in the flesh, uh-huh. for two, right? Others, maybe the ones who left the community, deny this claim. And they have this theology. They could represent the theology of docetism, right? From the Greek dokeo, which means to seem. And the idea is Jesus only seemed to be human, but was fully and only divine. So this is a non-corporeal view. And Jesus being non-corporeal in this way is associated with the spirit of the Antichrist by this author in 4:3. Now, again, that's not a supernatural agent, just false teachers, right? False teachers who are against this author's view. And then another possibility is that the heretics, right, the so-called heretics, are saying that Jesus isn't the divine Son of God. Now, Son of God is this earthly title. Kings from Caesar back to the Old Testament have all been sons of God, right, because they're kings. But there's this idea that Jesus is the divine Son of God, right, the literal Son of God. Ben, you had some interesting things to say about that in pre-show discussion. Would you mention those?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting when you brought up literal, right? Because when we say Jesus is the Son of God, you know, that can be taken multiple ways, right? Like you said, the ancient concept of that was just, it marked royalty, right? You know, it marked authority that someone was the Son of God because they had the sanction of the gods, so to speak. And then the Christians come along and they say, no, he's actually the Son of God, which, you know, you said literally, right? And Christians would say, yeah, he's literally the Son of God because the concept is that he was immaculately or divinely conceived in Mary and so by God, and he didn't have an earthly father, right? Well, you know, there is this idea within Mormonism, and I wouldn't say it's necessarily the, you know, idea of all Mormons, but this was definitely espoused by people like Bruce R. McConkie, that Jesus was the literal, like, and you know, and I emphasis more on the literal Son,
even more
God.
Literal.
Yeah, yeah. That his actual, you know, physical father was God the Father. So I don't know if this is a distinctly Mormon view. I would guess not. I would guess there are other Christian sects that at some point in history took on this view. And, you know, the more that you study some of these early texts, the more you realize, like, the diversity of views and doctrines and quote unquote heresies, right? And there's no univocality even within the text that we have canonized. And then you go back and you realize there's even more to the different movements and views that were, you know, very diverse among early Christians. So,
and to your point, we see that happening already here in the New Testament, right?
That's right. Now, the term Antichrist that we find, the first time that I noticed it was in verse 18 of chapter 2. And this is talking about those dissenters. And the interesting thing here about this term is that it is only used in 1st and 2nd John, in the whole New Testament. It only exists in 1st and 2nd John. And when I saw that in the commentary, I was like, no, that's that's not right. I know that it's in other books. It's in Revelation for sure, right? It's in Revelation. For sure,
right? Yeah.
I knew it was in Revelation, right? I just knew it was there because you're talking about the Antichrist. And so I look it up and it's like, no, it's not. We interpret terms that are in Revelation to be the Antichrist, but the word isn't there, right?
Of course.
And that was just such a fascinating exercise for me to realize, oh, the word's not there. However,
we're going to have so much fun with
Caveat Revelation. To that. However, it could be that this word Antichrist is a variant of a different Greek word that we do find in two of the Gospels, so in Mark and Matthew. And that term was pseudo-Christos, right? So false messiahs. And so this could be, you know, it's a very similar term. And it could be just a variant of that concept that we do find in the Gospels. So while the word is unique, the concept is maybe not.
I don't think so, Ben. I don't know. I don't think so. You know, because what this author is doing is he's saying those people who don't see Jesus as the Messiah in the same way I do are anti-Messiah.
Yeah.
And that's not the same thing as a false Messiah. I don't think it's the same thing.
So I think you're right about that, Christopher. I thought it was interesting that this was the view of one of the commentators that they thought that these terms were related. But I do think particularly in this verse here of chapter 2, and there may be another sense later which this term is used, it is referring to people who just don't agree, right? Don't believe the same things as these people. They don't believe that Christ is the same as the way that this community believes he is. So, you know, it's kind of like when some Christians accuse other Christians of not believing in the same Jesus, right?
Or the same God.
Yeah.
Or I don't like your opinion, therefore you're a fascist.
Yeah, yeah.
That and I don't even know what fascist means.
Yeah, yeah.
Or I don't like your religion, so it's a cult, and I don't even know what that means. And scholars don't even use that term anymore. And both of these terms, fascist and cult, have just sort of become throwaway terms. Right? Yeah. They're not even used anymore by academics. I mean, they use them with care, right? With caution.
Yeah. Well, if you ever use it, you then have to go on and explain for several paragraphs what you mean by it, right? Because there's so much baggage to the word.
And you have to, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it's just not a very useful word anymore because of it's got too much baggage to it. So,
and you know, that's something we've been talking about here, terms with baggage, right? This whole podcast, all the way through the Bible, right? There are these concepts. I mean, here we have sin again. You've defined sin on this episode in three different ways, according to three different authors in the New Testament.
Yeah. Yeah. Just within the letters here.
Yeah.
Now, back at the beginning of chapter 2, this first verse, we get this phrase that Jesus is the advocate with the Father.
Right? Oh, yeah.
And this gets picked up and used by Joseph Smith a ton in the Doctrine and Covenants. We find it throughout the Book of Mormon as well. And it's an interesting concept, and it kind of brings up an Old Testament setting of a courtroom. You know, we talked about this multiple times throughout the Old Testament. The first one that comes to mind for me is the Book of Job, kind of always comes up, right? Where you have the Satan coming before God. So
that's right. And in that case of the Satan, right, this is an accuser, and the Satan is someone who's working with God. And by the time we get to these letters, God has apparently lost control of Satan. He's gone, you know.
He's gone rogue.
He's gone rogue, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and so Jesus is in here, and he's our advocate with the Father. And, you know, before I've interpreted that, and I'm not sure how much stock I can put in this interpretation, but it was interesting to me to notice that preposition with here. Not necessarily to, but we talked about how Jesus is our advocate with the Father. And often we get this presentation of Jesus and the Father as sort of, you know, the Father being our adversary in some sense, right? God wants to punish us. And Jesus says, oh, you know, he comes in as our advocate and says, oh, no, don't do that, right? And one of the ways that we've approached this with this concept is talking about how Jesus is our advocate with the Father, right? It's not that God wants to punish us, right? So
that's the accuser. That's his job.
It's the accuser.
It's, you know, taking it that way, it sounds like God is the accuser.
Yeah.
But who knows? I mean, with Satan gone rogue, with the Satan, the accuser gone rogue, and now he's become the capital S Satan. Maybe God has to be the accuser. He lost his accuser. I don't know.
Now, Christopher, you brought up the concept of how atonement is used in this chapter. And in verse 2 of chapter 2, this gets used again. And it says, Jesus Christ the righteous, and he is the atoning sacrifice for our sins. And not for ours only, but also for the sins of the whole world. Now, this, again,
that's problematic in this epistle, right?
Yeah, exactly. This again, came up to me because it's just like, I can't figure out what the actual view of this author is. They seem to have a lot of cognitive dissonance. Like, on the one side, they do want to believe, you know, that God loves all of his children and wants to save them, right? You know, Jesus died for the sins of the whole world. And at the same time, he's calling anybody who disagrees with him an antichrist and a denier of Christ, and they're going to be punished by God and everything like that, right? So it
is, stay away from them.
It is a little bit confusing, a little dizzying, I guess I could say, as I go through this.
We should even compare them with, you know, sodomites, whose sin, by the way, was inhospitality.
Yeah, yeah.
And we should be inhospitable to them.
Yeah, exactly. So again, it gets a little dizzying as you continue with it. Now, there's this concept of a new commandment that took me a little bit, like I had to read this probably like 5 times to figure out, because in verses 7 and 8, it says no new commandment, but then it says it is a new commandment that is true in him and in you. And so it was like, okay, this isn't a new commandment. Like, you've heard this before, but it's new in the sense that it's coming alive in you, right? It's true in him and in you. This did make me think, and I think the idea here is the same that's expressed in the Gospel of John, where Jesus says, a new commandment I give unto you, that you love one another as I have loved you, right?
And what's new about that, Ben?
And what's new about that is that it's not just love your neighbor, right? We got that commandment already. That's not new, right? That's the old commandment. That's what it's always been. But Jesus says, no, don't just love your neighbor as yourself, right? Love one another as I have loved you.
Which ultimately, and it shows up in these writings, right, comes down to dying for those you love.
Yeah. Yeah, because also in the Gospel of John, we get, greater love hath no man than this, than he lay his life down for his friends. And so that same concept is expressed in here. These are all part of the things that we see kind of tie the rhetorical and conceptual framework of these letters with that of the Gospel of John. We can see it closely.
Yes, indeed.
Now, in verse 19, here we come to the part that I alluded to already. It says that if they had belonged to us, and this is talking about those dissenters, right, those antichrists that have gone away, they would have remained with us. But by going out, they made it plain that none of them belongs to us.
And now, so, there's a tautology.
It is. It's a tautology. It's like, they obviously don't belong to us because they left. And so it's really a way of otherizing. Right? It's a way of trying to explain how you had a division in a community that was supposed to be knit together by love and the love of God. How is it that the love of God wasn't able to keep this community together? Well, the author tries to explain this by saying, well, they didn't really belong here in the first place. That's why they had to leave, because they weren't really part of us. And there's some issues here, right? Besides the otherizing, I think that this isn't a healthy way to deal with grief. You've got a community that's divided. You've got people who used to be friends, who used to care for one another, and now they are parting ways. And this has to be painful for people in the community. And it seems like this author is approaching that division in an unhealthy way. Like, it's there's some bitterness going on, right? Rather than accepting the grief, the mourning, right, that we see in the Beatitudes, blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Instead, we get, you know, good riddance.
Yeah. You know, I'd like to plug an episode of our sister podcast, Latter-day Contemplation. I don't know the number, but there's an episode in which we interviewed Shiloh Logan. Now, Shiloh Logan was one of the co-founders of Latter-day Peace Studies, and he left the church. And after he left the church, we made an exception to our rule that we only interview persons who I self-identify as Latter-day Saints, right? We don't judge. It's not up to me who is a Latter-day Saint. It's those who identify. He did not, right? He actually resigned from the church. He had his names removed from the record. And we interviewed him because he's our friend. And we wanted to talk about how we can still be friends, right? How we can actually talk to people who have left our community, that we don't have to otherize them.
Yeah, yeah. So I think this is one of those times where we can look at how some people in the scriptures dealt with a situation and think that could have been done better. And one of the things that comes to mind is a discussion we had about Acts, when we have this story of Peter, and you have Ananias and Sapphira coming in, and they were supposed to consecrate everything they had, and they didn't do it. They held back, and they come in, and Peter starts accusing them, right? And it becomes in this accusatory thing. And that explains everything that happened. And then you kind of see Peter change in the very next chapter. He goes out and heals people and brings people in. And the way that I interpreted the arc of that narrative was that Peter, who in the Gospels does sort of take on an accusatory role. In fact, Jesus even calls him Satan at some point. Right, is acting that out. And so this was an example of, even though this is Peter, who we look to as some authority or example, a follower of Jesus, still had a moment, right, where he was acting within that accuser role. And we were able to look at that and say, this is not the right way to do it. We were able to look at this and rather than say, oh, this is how you run a church, we were able to say, this is how you don't run a church. Right.
Yes. And I liked your approach, Ben. I like your approach. This is an approach that I think we've had throughout and that I want to see us carry into the Book of Mormon, right? Because especially the Book of Mormon, because I think we have this idea that our sacred texts, right, that they give us the way, that they're an example of how to do things, right? And of course, that already presumes the univocality that we've already said doesn't exist in the text, right? But it also, it can really lead us astray, right? Because what if we're actually getting not models of excellence, right? But anti-models. Don't do it this way, right? We have to be able to use our own discernment.
Right. Now in chapter 3, there's this verse 4 that talks about sin being lawlessness, as sin is lawlessness. Now, we already talked a little bit about this, but I just wanted to bring up again, you know, we get some different definitions of sin explicitly. One here from this author, who we'll just go ahead and call John because that's how it's been attributed, says sin is lawlessness. Now, in Romans, Paul says sin is actually denying grace, and he talks about the law. And so, actually, I would say that Paul's view of sin and this author's view of sin, John's view of sin, are quite different. They're quite different. And then when we talked about the Epistle of James a little bit ago, James says that sin is knowing the right thing to do, knowing what is right, and not doing it. So it's kind of a little more of an omission type of thing, which in my view actually fits better with Paul's definition than this John definition of lawlessness. Now, I could probably try to fit them all together. I'm not going to. I think Paul's and James's approaches to the concept of sin make a lot more sense to me and in my experience than the way that this author frames it is just lawlessness.
And yet the way this author frames it is probably the way most do.
It's probably the way that is the most common view of sin. I agree. Yeah.
Right.
Now, in verse 8, we even get this statement, everyone who commits sin is a child of the devil. Now,
well, there you go.
We could take this a couple ways, right? I mean, we just got this statement back in chapter 1 that everyone who says that they're not a sinner is a liar. Okay, so I admit that I commit sin. And now that all of a sudden means that I'm a child of the devil. So what do I do here, right?
Ben,
I'm stuck.
You're reading too closely. You're not supposed to read this closely.
Yeah.
You're supposed to listen to the scriptures at least 2 times speed. while doing something else.
So obviously, I think there's going to be an issue with how this might be commonly read. You know, one of the ways we could view this, right? We wouldn't be required to view this as the person themselves as a child of the devil. What we could do is we could say, oh, well, whenever they sin, they're acting like a child of the devil, right? You could say that, I guess.
No, that's good apologetics, Ben.
Yeah.
No, so I mean, you know, it's this distinction you're making. It's something like who you are versus who you're being. Hmm. That's a distinction. It happens.
Or how you're acting. It's, yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Who you are versus who you're being. Yeah.
So verse 10, the children of God and the children of the devil are revealed in this way. And here we go, Christopher. All who do not do what is right are not from God, nor are those who do not love their brothers and sisters.
Well, who are your brothers and sisters? I mean, that's all the way back to who is my neighbor, right?
This really does beg the question, doesn't it? Because for this author, it appears that brothers and sisters seem to be just those who believe, who are part of this community and believe the same things as you, right? And that's what is meant by the requirement to love. So then in verses 16 through 18, we know love by this, that he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for one another. How does God's love abide in anyone who has the world's goods and sees a brother or sister in need and yet refuses help? Little children, let us love not in word or speech, but in truth and action.
Now, Ben, what if instead of finding, I don't know, you name it, that we can hold against somebody else and say, this verse right here says, and you're not doing it. What if instead we stood in front of the mirror and looked at this verse?
Yeah. These are some of the, you know, most beautiful verses in this. And I, like I said at the beginning, it's hard to read them and realize that the author may not be talking about a universal love for all of God's children, but maybe talking about a love just for those in the community. And yet we don't have to interpret it that way, because what we can do is we can say that the world is my community, right? I'm a citizen of the world. And so, like it says earlier in this epistle, that Christ didn't just die for our sins, but the sins of the whole world. And so he laid down his life for us, for all of us, and we ought to lay down our lives for one another.
You know, Ben, you reminded me of Marcus Aurelius, right? Because even Marcus Aurelius, he was a Roman emperor and he was a Stoic philosopher. And Stoicism taught since before Christianity, but including at the same time, right, as Christianity, because Seneca and Jesus were both born around the same time, between 6 and 4 BCE. And there was this idea of cosmopolitanism. And this was the ideal that Marcus Aurelius held himself to, while at the same time fighting the barbarians, right? He was fighting back the Germanic tribes on the northern borders of the empire his entire career as an emperor. And in fact, that's where and when he wrote the famous Meditations, right? Mm-hmm. But he says in the Meditations, he says, as Antoninus, right? Meaning as the Caesar, I'm Roman. But as a philosopher, right? As a Stoic, I'm a citizen of the world, right? The whole world. The whole world, the whole cosmos, right, is my polis. I am a cosmopolitan.
Yeah. So that last verse there, little children, let us love not in word or speech, but in truth and action. This did remind me of James, right? Faith without works is dead, you know?
Yes.
Love without actually doing something about it, right?
Yeah. By the way, just a quick note on the little children, right? We don't get until the third letter. I said the opening verse is identifying the author as an elder, right? So we do get, though, throughout these letters, this idea of little children. This is a rhetorical way of the author making himself an elder and making you a little children and, you know, talking to you in this way, such that he's adding authority to himself.
So now we're coming to chapter 4, and verse 8 of chapter 4 is probably, has been for me, probably the most iconic verse of this letter of John. It's the one that I remember the most. Whoever does not love does not know God, for God is love. God's love was revealed among us in this way. God sent his only Son into the world so that we might live through him.
Well, there it is, right? The author tells us that we should not be of the world because the world is bad and wrong, but God loved the world, right? Again, comparing this verse to John, the Gospel of John, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son.
Yeah. Yeah, there is some dissonance going on here, but this is such a beautiful verse. There's a lot going on in it, and it reminds me of a concept that you introduced me to, Christopher, and that was the idea that Jesus was God's aesthetic argument, right? And that how we know God is through the revelation of Jesus, is through Jesus' coming, so that we can actually see how God would act if he were here, and to follow him, right, to do as he does. And despite all of the revelation, the scriptures, the stories that we have, when Jesus comes, this is God's actual revelation of who he is, not these part and parcel and
God is respecter of persons.
Yeah, type of thing, right.
Yeah. And so, you know, my idea comes from, you know, John, because John is saying that Jesus is this logos, right? He's using this Greek philosophical term that means word, speech, paragraph, argument, right? Like a logical argument. Logos and logic are related. And I was saying that when God wants to make an argument, it's not in the form of logic, which is one of the branches of philosophy. You could call it that. It's also called epistemology, but rather aesthetics, which, by the way, is the highest branch, right? At the foundation of philosophy is metaphysics and epistemology. At the core of it is ethics. That's why I do it. And then out of that comes politics and aesthetics. And I remember, you know, Ayn Rand, who's one of these, you know, broken clocks or right twice a day examples, right? She says, this is how she puts it. Tell me what a man finds sexually attractive, and I'll tell you his entire philosophy of life, which is ironic given her weird sexual ideas, right? But it's an aesthetic argument she's making, right? If I know your aesthetics, I know your philosophy all the way down to your metaphysics, and this is the case, right? And so God presents this aesthetic argument. Do you want to know who I am? Do you want to know what I'm saying? Do you want to know my argument? Behold the man.
Behold the man. That was my thought as well, that mm-hmm. phrase. Yeah.
And this is also at the core, this idea is at the core of our, and it's not our cruciform hermeneutic, right? We borrowed the cruciform hermeneutic from Greg Boyd, right? From CrossVision. Yeah. And the idea of a cruciform hermeneutic is if Jesus is God incarnate, then we look to that man who died for us, right? On the cross. That's what we mean by cruciform. Hermeneutic meaning this is the lens through which we're going to read everything else in the scriptures. And what we added to that, Ben, is again from Shiloh. Shiloh introduced me to Greg Boyd too, by the way, to his work, is that the central teachings of Jesus. So we have Jesus as the personification, right? The incarnation of God. And we have his central teachings of the Sermon on the Mount as the touchstone for who and what God is and what his teachings are, what his doctrine is, right?
So verse 11, since God loved us so much, we also ought to love one another. And then there's this phrase, no one has ever seen God. If we love one another, God lives in us and his love is perfected in us. Now, that phrase seemed to come out of nowhere for me because, you know, it's talking about loving one another and sort of making an if-then statement. And then right in the middle of it is this phrase, no one has ever seen God. It's like, well, we weren't talking about seeing God. And so
I think I'm
not sure what that means.
I think I get it, Ben.
Okay.
I think I get it. I think it's just saying we don't see God, but we can experience God within ourselves, right? this, by the way, the advocate, right? Because the advocate is used here. We've talked about the advocate in this context, right? It's this, this is translating the Greek parakletos, right? And you've described what that means, right? This is our advocate with the Father. But that same word, parakletos, elsewhere is the Holy Spirit.
Yes.
In this context, it's an advocate, but it's the same word. And it's translated differently in the different contexts in which we find it in the New Testament. So I think it makes sense what he's saying, right? He's saying we don't actually experience God manifest, right? But we do within us. And it's interesting because, of course, I just said that the incarnation of God that we can experience, at least through these writings or writings like the Gospels, right, is Jesus. And yet, as Paul pointed out, as Paul had to deal with, right, he's no longer with us. And yet he is in the parakletos, right, in the paraclete, which again, back there in Paul is translated as the Holy Spirit. Here, for some reason, it's going to be an advocate with the Father. The other thing that's curious about this verse, Ben, is Moses saw God according to the Old Testament.
Yeah.
According Isaiah to this too. Text, Isaiah too, according to this text, no one has seen God. And according to Christians, again, Jesus is God and we saw him. So,
yeah. Well, again, according to this tradition too, you know, the Gospel of John says, you know,
that's
Jesus
right.
is God. So,
that's right. So we have, again, some kind of, well, we have contradictions, we have a lack of univocality, not only among authors, but even sometimes within the same author.
Within the same chapter.
Within the same chapter.
This did make me think, because of this concept of love and that God lives in us and we experience God through the love that is between us, right? Because his love perfected us. That did make me think of the Beatitude, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God, right?
Yes.
Because this Beatitude has become so much more meaningful to me when I have seen it as not necessarily or not only some like future state of after death or resurrection, I see God, right? But this is in the moment. This is talking about now in our life.
Right.
And how is it that we see God? Well, if you're pure in heart, then we're seeing God in our neighbor, we're seeing God in our enemy, and we're seeing God in ourselves, in the
That's
mirror.
Right. And how do we get there? We have to start at the beginning, right?
Yeah.
Of the Sermon on the Mount. Yeah. We have to empty ourselves so that we can be filled with God. We have to empty ourselves of our ego. That ego self, that false self, so that our true self, which is in the image of God, which is divine, can shine through.
Yeah. Going to verse 18, there is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear. For fear has to do with punishment. Now, this is an interesting concept here, is that, you know, we're talking about God is love. And if we don't know God, we don't know love. If we don't know love, we don't know God. And it says, perfect love casts out fear, for fear has to do with punishment. Well, what does that say about the relationship between God and punishment?
It's not his thing.
It's not for him. That's what it says. That's what I see it saying. And whoever fears has not reached perfection in love. We love because he first loved us. Those who say I love God and hate their brothers and sisters are liars. For those
Again,
who do not
what
love
kind
a
of...
brother or sister whom they have seen cannot love God whom they have not seen.
Again, what's going on with this author? I think the answer is, again, the more things change, the more they stay the same. The ones that we're supposed to love are the ones who think like us. They're the righteous, right? Righteous, they're the ones who are just, right? The ones who think like us are right. The ones who don't think like us are wrong. And we love the ones who think like us, and we can feel free to hate the ones who don't think like this. But this is not consonant with the teachings of Jesus.
Right.
At all.
Yeah.
And it shows up even in this context. It just shows up as a contradiction within the very text in which it's written. And again, the only thing that I can do to make sense of it is to parse it out in the way I did. And it's not that hard to see it because we still do it.
Yeah, we do. And it's a cognitive dissonance on our part. And I'm seeing it in this author. And I don't I don't know how much I can fault the author for it, right? You know, it showed up, it's now become canon and all these people read it, right? And maybe get the wrong idea from it or something. But in any case, you know, we all do this, right? We all talk about how we should love one another. And then, you know, we shake our fist at the guy who cuts us off on the road first thing we get. So,
oh, that's nothing, Ben. That was a tame example.
Okay. You want a better one?
Sure, let's hear it.
We all talk about loving our neighbor, and then, you know, we cheer for war.
Yeah. So. We all talk about loving our enemies. We talk about dying, right? Dying, and instead we kill, or we condone killing. Yeah. We talk about following him. Where did he go? To death. Where do we go? To kill.
Yeah.
And we read the Book of Mormon, and we want to be like Captain Moroni. And who follows Jesus? The anti-Nephi Lehis. Mm-hmm. They follow him to their own deaths. And what happens? In a book full of wars and battles, you have the lowest body count of any battle in the whole book and the highest conversion rate.
And even Mormon's commentary says it's because of their love.
Because of their love.
Chapter 5, verse 3, for the love of God is this, that we obey his commandments, and his commandments are not burdensome. Now, this is a little bit of a twist.
This is where the author's sin concept comes from.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, and this does echo, though, what we find in John 4, if you love me, keep my commandments, though.
Right? That's right.
You know, there's some of that there. Now, verse 19 of chapter 5, I thought was an interesting one as well. He says, we know that we are God's children, and that the whole world lies under the power of the evil one. So again, this is the, hey, you know, we're the chosen people and everybody else is wicked. This is the Ramiumptum motif.
Children here, of the right? devil.
This is the Ramiumptum archetype.
That's right. They're all children of the devil.
Yeah.
We're the good guys. They're the bad guys.
Anything else you want to say about 1 John, Christopher?
No, I don't have anything to add, Ben. Let's move on to the second letter.
Yeah, so 2 John. So we had said that this is likely the same author as 1 John. Again, you know, the scholars generally agree that these three letters probably have the same author. There's disagreement about who that author is, but they're anonymous, right? They don't even say that they're John. These are just attributed to some person named John. Whether that John is John, the brother of James, the son of Zebedee, or just somebody else, right?
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I would say is, again, maybe the third letter is by a different author.
Yeah.
But they're all three Johannine, right? That's the important thing.
Yeah.
And we've really been able to, you know, to bring that out in the first letter so far.
Now, one of the interesting things here about 2 John is that it may have come before 1 John historically, might have been written, because it doesn't speak explicitly about dissenters. I mean, it does talk about, you know, people who are deceivers that have gone out, but it doesn't talk about explicitly some sort of schism that's happening in the community. And so some of the commentary said it's possible this letter was written, you know, before or just before that schism kind of came about. So even though it's what we have is the 2 John, it might be historically predate 1 John.
You know, I'm reminded again, just by what you said, the way that came out, you know, it's just anyone who leaves the community is now a deceiver, right?
Yeah.
They are wrong, black and white, wrong. We're right, they're wrong, right? There's no gray. And right. That's just not like life.
It's just not like right? reality.
It's just not like reality. Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. Now, one of the commentators had some interesting things to say about this concept, you know, the harsh treatment of the false teachers. He said, the elders' harsh treatment, and when I say the elders, it's talking about the author, because the author of the Second John identifies himself as the elder, right? So the elders' harsh treatment of false teachers strikes modern readers as contradicting the Johannine ethical teaching of mutual love. If the impact of the schism was as serious as the language of 1 John suggests, when it treats false teachers as antichrists, then 2 John might represent a type of quarantine measure to protect other communities from this disease. Some scholars think that a copy of 1 John was sent along with this letter.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, you know, from this commentator, this scholar, their view would be that this was written after 1 John, not before. So, again, could be either way. So, immediately, this letter is addressed to a person called the Elect Lady. Now, this isn't likely a person, an individual, right? This is rather the personification of the church community as an elect lady, which totally makes sense within the Christian tradition. You know, first off, in the Old Testament, the covenant people of God were the bride, right? And so even the community of the church is considered, is feminine, right? It's the bride and the bridegroom is coming. And so to be personified as a woman, the community makes sense within the whole Christian tradition. But here we have it in this verse.
Yes, and this is translating kuria, which is the feminine form of kurios, which is Lord. Yeah. This is lady, as in lords and ladies.
Yeah. Again, there's this discussion about a new commandment. And this word new seems to be more of a title or of the commandment than a designation of it actually being new. And I think that was kind of interesting, again, in light of what we get from the Gospel of John, a new commandment I give unto you, that you love one another as I have loved you. A distinguishing feature of the identity of this community that sees love as their unifying, you know, function. Right. And so let us love one another is this new commandment, right?
Yes. Of course, they're also unified by hate of the other.
Yeah. Or aversion, at least. Yeah. Disgust or something.
Well, I mean, we get in verse 10, do not receive into the house or welcome anyone who comes to you and does not bring this teaching, right? If they don't believe like us, then because it says in verse 11, for to welcome is to participate in the evil deeds of such a person. I mean, this is just like Jesus when he stays away from the sinners. And he does not welcome them.
Right.
He is not welcomed by them. He has nothing to do with them. I mean, this is nothing like Jesus, Ben.
Right. Well, it's not even like Peter. I mean, in Acts we get that Peter is called by God, you know, he has a revelation that he's supposed to go into the house of a Gentile, somebody who's unclean. And so it's a different idea. This community is very concerned with their integrity as such. And so they want to maintain, there's this boundary maintenance, right? They want to maintain the integrity of their boundaries and identity. And there's some difficulty here because their identity is based on love, but now they're having to, you know, sort of use that identity in a contradictory way.
Yes, and in verse 7, right, we get this warning against deceivers. Well, what are deceivers? Again, this is the Antichrist, right? This is a term, again, only appears in these letters, right? These Johannine epistles, the Antichrist. And in this letter, it's used to describe these so-called deceivers. It's neologism, this new word, only used here and in 1 John 2:18 and in 4:3.
Yeah, and this is the one where we might get sort of a hint at what the heresy was that they were preaching against, because it says that the deceivers are those who do not confess that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh.
There it is. So. It could be docetism.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, you have this prohibition against giving hospitality to deceivers, and it's given on moral grounds, which is really strange, considering that the context, right, both Greco-Roman and Jewish traditions have this idea of hospitality as a primary virtue, right? Philoxenia, right? So philo, love, of xeno, right? If you've seen my Big Fat Greek Wedding movie, right? Xeno with the Tost family, right? Xeno is a foreigner, so this is love of strangers. Foreigner can, xeno can also be translated stranger, right? Stranger in a strange land, that makes you a foreigner. Mm-hmm. This is an important virtue in antiquity. It is paramount. And by the way, I have to say, this virtue is alive and well in the Arab world.
Yeah.
And perhaps nowhere else. I mean, there are those of us. I mean, in our home, we know no strangers. We've had so many people live with us and eat with us, right? All kinds of people, right? But as a whole, right, as a society, I don't think I know of any other society that still has this virtue other than Arab society.
That does remind me, Christopher, the first time that I ever came to your house, I showed up a little early. I think I brought some pizza, and I started talking with a guy that was living there with his wife. He was from Turkey, and he was just living with you. And I thought, yeah, it's this guy living with Christopher is from Turkey. And we had this long, interesting conversation. And I unfortunately don't really remember much of what we talked about, or I don't even remember his name. You'll know his name because he lived with you. But yeah, I definitely can attest to that.
That's one example. Yeah. That's one example. His name is Chada. He was a political refugee.
Yeah.
He lived with us along with his Russian wife. He was Turkish and his wife was Russian. Mm-hmm. And he was a political refugee.
Okay, let's go to 3 John. Now, this is a little different from the others in that it's not meant as like a general epistle to a community or the church as a whole, but this is more of a private letter. Christopher, you said it looks like it might be some sort of recommendation given. It's possible also you noted that it feels different in a lot of ways that might be a different author.
Yeah, and I want to jump right into this, into verse 9, right? Because it's interesting because there's a community member who snubbed the elder. He doesn't acknowledge our authority, it tells us.
Yeah.
Meaning, literally, that what's being translated, he doesn't acknowledge our authority, is literally does not welcome us. This is the same verb used in verse 10. It's a breach of hospitality, contravening social convention. I mean, what's going on with this author?
Yeah, if it's the same author, he does have a little bit of some dissonance here because he just in 2 John was saying, oh, you can't welcome other people in because they believe differently.
You know, here's how he's consistent. I think I've got this figured out. And I think we've already said this, Ben. Either you're one of us, like either you're with us or you're against us, right? It's like that.
Yeah, here's how he's consistent. I'm right, you're wrong.
Right. And so whatever it is that that Jesus taught applies only to those people who think like me. And if they don't think like me, it doesn't apply to them.
Yeah.
And again, this is not foreign to us in our own context.
And still, this is this short little letter. And right after he talks about this person who has snubbed them, has not welcomed them, he says this really interesting thing. This beautiful thing. He says, do not imitate what is evil, but imitate what is good. It's almost like he's saying, yes, they did this to you, but don't you do the same. But it's hard to say whether he's saying that because he says the opposite sometimes.
I love what you did with that. You see, this could be read the other way around. What you just showed us, and this I see this all the time, Ben. You showed us not what the verse says, but who you are. Right. And that's what I've seen people use. I recently saw this. I saw someone use a verse to, you know, this is proof texting or Bible bashing or whatever. He was using the verse to say, look, this verse is dealing with evil people, and these evil people must be the ones on this side of the aisle. Yeah. And he's saying this to someone who is on the other side of the aisle, right? Yeah. Who would read the same verse as, no, no, no.
Yeah.
No, this verse is about the people on your side of the aisle, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so I like the way you read it, Ben. I think, you know, the way you read it just shows me why we're friends.
Whoever does good is from God. Whoever does evil has not seen God. That is a little bit different formulation. And I like it better than the way it's whoever does good is from God, whoever does evil is from the devil, right? Whoever does evil has not seen God. That's an interesting concept, right? Because
no one has seen God according to this author, sure. Earlier epistle. So what's going on?
I'm kind of thinking of this as like an in the moment thing, right?
Yes.
Like the way you're acting right? You're acting in your ego or whatever. You're acting against what you know to be right is because you're not seeing God in it.
Or in them.
In the moment.
In yourself, in your interlocutor, in the moment, indeed.
Yeah. Just in the world around you.
It's almost a tautology at that point, right?
Yeah. Well, that is 3 John for me. I didn't have any other commentary on it.
And I have nothing else to add myself.
Okay.
Now we come to the first 2 Peter.
Yeah.
The letter of Jude.
That's right.
First 2 Peter.
2
right?
Peter A. Yeah, Jude. Okay, this is something different. And Christopher, when I had first kind of started reading this and listening to it, I just sent you a little message. I said, Jude is weird.
It is. It's really weird. I mean, again, because it's dealing with this whole idea of... So there are two ideas in the Judeo-Christian tradition, broadly speaking, about where evil comes from. One is Adam and Eve. And that's the later and the idea and the one that we have stuck with. The other idea has to do with the Nephilim, right? With these fallen angels who want to have sexual intercourse with the daughters of men. And this is in First Enoch, right? It's hinted at in Genesis. It may even be, I think I found it in the Quran, right? I think it may be something that we can see. I'm thinking of Quran Surah Al-Baqarah, the cow, right? That's the second surah, chapter 2, verse 30. There's something going on with, and it's strange. It's really strange.
Yeah.
And I don't know what to make of it. Again, Enoch is not canon. It's this extra canonical work. And what is it doing here in Jude? And then in 2 Peter, which again, we mentioned last time, looks like it's copied from Jude. Leaving out certain myths, right? Certain, what were they called? Carefully crafted myths or something like that?
Yeah, carefully crafted myths. It is interesting, yeah, that 2 Peter may be copying this, but then commenting on, oh, well, you know, I like some of the things Jude said, but I don't believe in this other nonsense, right?
Yeah, there's another weird thing here too, which again is from extra canonical sources about how the devil was fighting over the body of Moses.
Yeah, with Michael.
With Michael, right. Yeah, with the Archangel Michael. Strange.
It's a really very strange stuff. Reference. Yeah, it is.
Can we just stop here? It's really weird. The end.
We could. I want to say a couple things about authorship. I mean, so the author identifies himself as Jude, the brother of James. And so like my question is, okay, which James? I think the author probably means the brother of Jesus. But then that would make this Jude... which is also Judas or Judah, right? It just depends what language you're going to pull it from. So that would make this Judas also the brother of Jesus. So why doesn't he say so? Why doesn't he say Jude, the brother of Jesus? Why does he say the brother of James?
Yeah, and Judas, the brother of Jesus, was also thought of as Thomas, right? The apostle
possibly.
Thomas. Yeah, so
possibly.
He, you know, from John's gospel, and because the name appears there, right, together is Judas Didymus Thomas.
Well, that's Didymus a different Judas. There's multiple Judas.
Well, that's the question. That's the question.
Yeah.
Didymus and Thomas mean twin in Greek and Aramaic, respectively. And so you have this extra canonical gospel of Thomas, something we've talked about here, and especially on Latter-day Contemplation. Riley and I have gone into the gospel of Thomas. And so in there, in the Gospel of Thomas, you have this extra canonical Acts of Thomas, by the way, there's another one, and it sees Judas Thomas as Jesus' twin brother.
Right.
Jesus' twin brother. Go figure.
Yeah, that would be a different view than the conventional one, right? Now, you know, if we're talking about Judas, the brother of Jesus, there are statements in the Gospels that say that none of his brothers believed on him, right? And so if we go with that, then we couldn't put one of them as one of his apostles. But, you know, we've got different traditions, obviously, fronting different views of things. And, you know, even the Gospels we had, Christopher, it was difficult for us to 100% identify a consistent 12 apostles, right? The names of all of them. So
that's right. We did say good luck with that if you're trying to figure out who the 12 apostles are.
Now, you know, scholars can't necessarily refute the claimed authorship of this, right? That the author identifies himself as Jude, the brother of James. But as I read it, I really get the sense that this is more likely pseudonymous. I would expect that the views of Judas would be closer to those of James. And this is assuming that the epistle of James, the letter of James that we have, really is James in some form, right? A collection of his sayings or something, which I do think it is. This letter, though, just seems more concerned with sets of beliefs and then, you know, destruction of the wicked. And that wasn't really James's concern in his epistle at all.
No, this is the one theme that actually unifies this with the other, you know, the Johannine epistles that we're covering this week, right? The idea that there are these immoral intruders, right, that challenge institutional authority. In fact, you know, it reminds one of Paul and his opponents in Corinth, right? In 1st and 2nd Corinthians, maybe the Gnostics, right? There's another one.
Could be, yeah.
Or there were these ongoing conflicts over how to understand, you know, salvation from sin, right? Grace. Because we have some teachers, you know, some saying that thanks to God's salvation, there's no longer any earthly authority that we're bound to. So you couldn't really, you know, you didn't have to worry about your salvation. There's nothing that you could do spiritually. You're safe, right? There's nothing that can go wrong for you. But then there's also these stereotypical accusations of licentiousness, right? And those sound like the prophets. And then, you know, maybe this has to do with sexual license or impiety, thinking of Ezekiel 16. Who knows, Ben?
It is strange.
I'm leaning heavily here on the introduction in my study Bible.
Yeah. So one of the things we alluded to is this author's reference to the different examples of evil people throughout quote unquote history, but throughout the scriptures that God has punished. But first off, you know, the author starts in verse 5 talking about the saved people. He saved the people from Egypt. Well, that's Exodus, right? And Christopher, we've said multiple times, really the only thing that happens in the Bible is Exodus, and everything else is kind of a commentary. So here we are, Jude, almost to the end of the New Testament, the end of the Bible, and sure enough, it's just a commentary on Exodus. So that's given as the example of how God can save people, and then he starts listing examples, split between some verses, of groups of people that were condemned and destroyed. So we've got the angels who were cast down. Now, Christopher, I know that we have something to talk about with this because last time we missed a particular point on Tartarus, right?
That's
about
right.
About the angels being cast down. And this would be the similar concept going on here.
Yeah, that's right. Because 2 Peter and Jude again compare, right? 2 Peter's probably copying from Jude. Yeah, so last time it was in 2 Peter, right?
Yes.
Get hell. And hell in the NRSV was translating Tartarus. Well, this isn't Hades. Homer, I said that Tartarus was as far beneath Hades as the earth was below the heavens, right? Or beneath the heavens. And so what is this Tartarus? And you actually know the answer, and you meant to bring it up last time and forgot, right?
Yeah, so Tartarus in the Greek concept, this is the prison or whatever that the Titans were locked in, right? That Zeus locks the Titans in. And so this is a similar concept to where we're talking about like angels cast down from heaven, right? These are powerful beings cast out of heaven and then locked in this prison that isn't just underground. It's like way down there, right? So...
yeah, you know, again, a lot of this stuff, right, it comes from First Enoch. You have, of course, this story that we mentioned about Michael and the devil arguing over the body of Moses, right? This really strange stuff. Ben, you know, again, it seems that you and I really need to read First Enoch, right?
Now, yeah, it keeps coming up.
This extra-canonical book of First Enoch, right, it comes down to us from the Ethiopic Christian tradition. That's where it survives. Although there are some Aramaic fragments that were found in Qumran too. And that's interesting.
That, You know, and between that and the other extra canonical or apocryphal works that get referenced or alluded to, not just in pseudo-Paul, but by Paul, and seem to be sources for a lot of these New Testament writers, I do have to sort of smile a little bit at conversations I've had with people before that will say something like, you know, I don't believe in any extra biblical sources. And the problem is that it's like, well, what Bible are you talking about, right? You know, even right. Different traditions have different sources in their Bible. But even if they want to say, oh, well, we're going to talk about, you know, just these ones, the issue is you run into this problem where Jude right. is referencing all these other texts. And it's like, okay, if Jude thinks that these other texts are authoritative, then how are you saying they're not, right? So,
right. Yeah. Right. Jude thinks they're authoritative, and we've decided Jude is canon, but they're not. So again, the process of canonization is somewhat arbitrary, if not completely arbitrary. We have texts in our canon that are pseudepigraphical, and some of this was known early on. Some of it is known much later, right? We have extra canonical stuff that maybe should have been in the canon, and stuff in the canon that shouldn't have been in the canon. And then again, this is an opinion. Even I'm just stating an opinion, right? But I think I've given a little bit of a sense of why I'm saying this, right? I think in the end, though, what I usually come down to is, why aren't we reading all of this, right? So yeah. Instead of, you know, you have these interpretations of these canonical works that come from extra canonical works that you're not reading. Read them. Read the Gospel of Thomas. Read 1st Enoch. I'm going to read it. You know, there are even books that are in, as you pointed out, Ben, not everyone has the same canon, right? The Catholics have books in their canon that we don't have in our canon because the Protestants took it out. Yeah. And I know that for Latter-day Saints, there's this idea that comes from Bruce R. McConkie, right? That the Catholic Church is the Church of the Devil. And of course, they took that out. By the way, the whole Book of Mormon Doctrine, the brethren told him, you can't call your book Mormon Doctrine because it's not. And he did it anyway, and he got away with it. The only thing they made him do was to take the Catholic Church out as the Church of the Devil. But the reality is, we are much more aligned. Latter-day Saintism is much more aligned with Catholicism than it is with Protestantism. And then again, and I've already spoken of the debunking of the great apostasy narrative, but if there were a great apostasy, then it's creeping back in. And Latter-day Saintism is trying to move toward evangelical Christianity, which it's not. It's not Protestant. It's not evangelical. It's actually closer to Catholicism. And this is something, and it's very much, it's closer still to Eastern Orthodox Christianity, which most Latter-day Saints know nothing about. So go find out. There, you know, just like I'm reading from a Jewish annotated New Testament, that's where I'm studying from, since leaving aside Sarah Rudin, who only gave us a translation of the Gospels. You're reading from, what is it, the Oxford annotated, an Oxford study Bible. There's an Eastern Orthodox study Bible. I have one on my Kindle. I didn't even look at that for this, you know. If I were studying the New Testament all over again, I might do that. Instead of this,
there's so much, you know, and in our tradition, we believe the canon is open. And so, you know, I think that it behooves us to be open, to ourselves be open to understanding these things, right? Because we don't know where we can find truth until we look for it.
That's right.
Now, there's this verse 18 that, has a quote in it. It seems to be quoting the apostles, is what the author says here. It says, the apostles said, quote, in the last time there will be scoffers indulging their own ungodly lusts. Now, the issue here is that we can't find really this quote from any apostles, right? The source of this would be unknown. But to me, this sounded an awful lot like Timothy, where we have pseudo-Paul in Timothy saying, you know, in the last days will come, and then it lists all of these things. And this really kind of fit within that tone for me. I wondered if this might be alluding to a statement like that within Timothy. And then this could, you know, be dated later than 1 Timothy, where that would be. But it kind of spoke to the authorship a little bit to me. I didn't think Judas, you know, the brother of James, would be quoting Paul. So,
right. Yeah. So, Ben, the only thing I have here on this is, you know, from a footnote, it looks like Jude is quoting from 1 Enoch 1:9. And I didn't read that, right? I'm just reading from my study Bible, a footnote, right? And there's a reference in that verse, right, in 1 Enoch 1:9, to the Lord. And Jude here is taking the Lord to be Jesus. But that's how this works, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, of course, this is, you know, every reference to God or the Lord in the Old Testament within the Christian tradition, it becomes about Jesus. That's so Jude's doing that too. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. So that is John and Jude. And Christopher, we are gearing up to talk about the book of Revelation.
Come on.
Which is a beast, right?
It is. Pun fully intended, I presume.
Yeah. Okay.
There's a beast in there, at least.
That's right. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Christopher, for podcasting, for recording here with me. I appreciate your company. Yeah.
Thank you, Ben. I wouldn't have done it without you. Not this week.
Have a good week, everyone.